This is Earth Files, the award-winning news site with the latest updates in science, environment, and real X-Files. Podcasting in-depth reports beyond the 6 o'clock news by Emmy Award-winning journalist Linda Moulton Howe.
The Washington Post, on May 16, 2007, printed an editorial by three highly respected American scientists in which these words were stated, quote, "Climate change is the most critical problem the Earth has ever faced," unquote. That frank statement about global warming came from the director of the Scripps Institute of Oceanography at the University of California, San Diego, the dean of the College of Oceanic and Atmospheric Sciences at Oregon State University, and the acting director of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Their combined words came in their appeal for more NASA funding to sustain and increase the satellites now watching Earth, gathering data that describe our planet's rapid change as the Earth heats up. One of their big concerns was satellite data in January of this year that showed higher ocean temperatures are reducing the growth of microscopic plants and animals that are at the heart of the marine food chain. Plankton decline would mean lack of food for a wide range of marine animals. Animal and plant extinction rates are already accelerating. Eminent Harvard biologist Edward O. Wilson predicts that in the face of global warming, half of all plant and animal species will be extinct by 2100. That's only 90 years away. And now comes a sobering satellite study that shows it was warm enough for a week or two in January 2005 for Western Antarctic ice to melt over an area as big as the state of California. Such a huge ice melt in Western Antarctica is unprecedented and could mean that global warming is even getting to the thick ice of the South Pole. Right after the release of that satellite data, the highly respected British University of East Anglia's Tyndall Center for Climate Change Research had its analysis of carbon dioxide content in the South Ocean around Antarctica published in a May 2007 journal issue of Science. Because the Antarctic South Ocean is so cold, it has been considered one ocean body that could absorb a lot of atmospheric carbon dioxide, and therefore could help balance out CO2 emissions from cars and industries. Ocean waters that absorb CO2 are called sinks. But the UK scientists found, quote, "The data from 1981 through 2004 show the CO2 sink is already full of carbon dioxide. We find this really quite alarming," unquote. Up until now, the Antarctic Southern Ocean alone was accountable for 15% of the worldwide carbon dioxide sink. If that cold Antarctic water is saturated with CO2 from the atmosphere, that means many other regions of the Earth's oceans must also be saturated. One American glaciologist who has spent the last 15 years studying Antarctic ice is Ted Skambos, PhD in geology, lead glaciology scientist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center, and senior research scientist at the University of Colorado in Boulder. This week, I talked to Dr. Skambos about the implications in both the January 2005 California-sized ice melt in Western Antarctica and the recent discovery that the Southern Ocean around Antarctica is so full of carbon dioxide that it won't be able to absorb much more. First, Dr. Skambos talks about the unprecedented January 2005 ice melt in Western Antarctica.
It was a brief period, a week or two, where a large area of snow melted briefly and formed a thin ice layer right there in place in Antarctica. Now, what's interesting and important about it is that in many places it was unprecedented. We'd never seen anything like this in the past 25 years. Now maybe what we're seeing is the beginning of a trend for Antarctica to warm up too, and the real problem with that is that Antarctica represents a huge amount of ice and therefore sea level rise. And so if this trend were to continue over the next several decades, there might be more areas than just the Antarctic Peninsula that start to show a response to a warming trend in the form of accelerating glaciers and more meltwater coming off of the continent, beginning to have an effect on sea level. And I fully expect that we'll see more ice shelves crumble away into the ocean, and I'd be real surprised if the glaciers behind them didn't accelerate. But the Antarctic Peninsula doesn't represent nearly the threat that the main landmass of Antarctica represents in terms of sea level rise. It's really the sleeping giant of this whole climate change picture and sea level rise picture. And if West Antarctica begins to warm rapidly, if we begin to see year after year, or we start to see every other year the same kind of California-sized area of melt, then we know that climate really has begun to change in Antarctica, that warmer air is starting to mix in during the summer more than it used to. And yeah, that would be quite serious in terms of projections for sea level rise.
Couldn't this whole scenario that you've just described be accelerated if this new data coming out of the University of East Anglia in Britain is correct, that, and I'm just going to summarize it and then ask you if you would comment on the implications. This was released on May 17th of 2007. The summary of what they have found is that the Southern Ocean around Antarctica is so loaded with carbon dioxide that it can barely absorb any more. So more of the gas, meaning the CO2, will stay in the atmosphere to warm up the planet further.
Yeah, it does have an impact on this melt rate, not just for the Antarctic, but all over the world. The atmosphere is very well mixed, and so the fact that the Southern Ocean can't absorb CO2 the way it used to means that the rate of increase throughout the atmosphere that we've seen measured accurately since the 1950s, that rate will begin to steepen. We'll get more greenhouse gas in the atmosphere faster. And that means that when you look down the road for the next century, as the IPCC did, and they looked at several models of how greenhouse gases could impact climate and could impact various systems, rainfall, surface temperature, ice melt, the scenarios that included a more rapid increase of CO2 that were considered the extreme cases are going to be closer to the likely cases. If we really do begin to see a steeper increase in greenhouse gases because the ocean can't absorb as much CO2 as it used to. Now, the Southern Ocean is a big area. It's not the entire ocean. However, it's the one that you'd expect would absorb the most CO2 because the surface waters are quite cold. There are other things that occur in the Southern Ocean. There's a huge ecosystem in the Southern Ocean that absorbs carbon from the atmosphere biologically and forms in the process of plankton growing. And when those plankton die, they sink to the ocean bottom and they sequester. They take the carbon dioxide from the atmosphere with them to the ocean bottom. So there's a very complex picture behind the whole carbon balance story that the atmosphere and the Earth have. And so I guess I take a wait-and-see attitude towards whether or not CO2 levels will start to increase more steeply as a result of this near-saturated condition that's been reported for the Southern Ocean.
But isn't it true that the Southern Ocean accounts for 15% of the global carbon sink? And if it has filled up now or nearly so, doesn't that mean that other regions of the ocean must be almost full of CO2 as well?
I think that's a plausible guess and may well be the case. I think I'd want to see a study that considered how the rest of the carbon system is going to react to more CO2 in the atmosphere, to a saturated Southern Ocean before I really leapt out and said, we'll see a carbon dioxide increase at this or that rate. I think we'd need to take a look at some of the other systems on Earth and how they're behaving. There are also human things that are going to have an impact on this. How fast do China and India modernize and electrify? And will we be able to convince them to do things like sequester carbon dioxide at power plants or use alternate energy sources, as I hope the Western world begins to do? Maybe that will change the carbon balance in a different way. So, again, I think what they're saying is definitely cause for concern, but making a prediction that we'll have that more extreme CO2 by the end of the century It's still a bit premature, but that's what their study implies.
The UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in 2007 laid out that there could be an average global temperature warming on this planet between now and the next 90 years between 3 degrees and 11.5 degrees Fahrenheit, and 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit over the next 90 years would be three times the warming of the last century's 100 years. What is the worst case in your educated mind about what could happen to the weather around this planet?
Oh, boy. Well, first of all, it can't be any more urgent. The problem that we're facing couldn't be any more urgent. Everywhere we turn, as a polar scientist, we're seeing that the progress of global warming is proceeding faster than we thought it was. We had a recent study from NSIDC that showed that sea ice is retreating faster than we thought it would for this level of CO2. Similarly, we're seeing a response in Greenland, extensive melt. Now we're seeing Antarctica, which had up to now been mostly isolated except for the peninsula. We can't have more urgency or clearer data that the time to begin to act is now. What's the ultimate consequence for climate in the world? I think what you'll see are several areas seriously impacted in terms of their ability to grow food, their ability to get water to all of the folks that live there. Which areas exactly will that be? It's hard to say. Different models show different scenarios. But the potential for having drought in the Southwest, drought in Southeast Asia, one of the great growing regions of the world, one of the great bread baskets or rice baskets of the world, failing to deliver a crop sufficient to feed everybody. These are real possibilities by the second half of this century. And we've got to begin to act now, or we're going to have a titanic refugee problem. Dislocations of people, dislocations, there's going to be a huge pressure on the wealthy nations to try and adapt or defend. There'll be security-related issues against this pressure that's being put on by climate change occurring throughout the world. Science is doing the best job it can to tell people that we see the early warning signs and we see them clearly, and the prospects for the future are not good. We don't want to consider all of the negative things that might happen. We know that we're in for a big, big change, and in general, change is expensive, and in some cases, deadly. So what we're going to need to do is start to act now to turn this around.
But the CO2 blanket that now surrounds the Earth and is causing the warming that we have been discussing is not going to change for 200 years, even if India and China stop pumping CO2 into the atmosphere or the United States or England tomorrow. We are stuck with a very thick CO2 blanket, and several scientists that I have talked to in 2007 who are atmospheric physicists say it's already, from their point of view, too late, that what the political urgency is beginning to form now in 2007 should have happened 25 years ago.
The idea that it's too late ignores the fact that if we don't begin to do something now, it only gets worse, and the changes only get worse, the cost of it only gets worse. So you say it's too late, and what you're saying is it's too late for the status quo. The status quo is going to change. Fine. How much is it going to change by? Well, a little or a lot. Let's make it a little and try now to find these alternative energy sources.
At the current measured rate of CO2 increase and consequential warming incrementally over, let's say, just the next decade, do you think it is fair to say that we should be prepared for more Katrinas and more F5 tornadoes like the one that just devastated Greensburg, Kansas?
In the next 10 years.
Right.
That would be my guess, that there will be more of those. That's about as far as I'll go.
And the insurance companies are already withdrawing insurance support from coastal areas, especially in Florida. It's expected that most people with any homes on coasts are no longer going to be able to get any insurance. What kind of pressure do you think that will do?
Those are going to be real economic costs for not doing anything. Now, you're absolutely right. They're going to have to adapt anyway, and we're going to have to figure out a way out of this with a certain amount of warming and increase in CO2 anyway over the next 50 years. But not acting upon the signals that we're seeing now and the impacts that we're seeing now means that the situation gets worse by the end of the century and in the century after that. I personally want to be able to say to my grandkids that we took a big step when we saw it happening during one generation that we were impacting global climate, that we began to address the problem. We can't solve it all in one generation, but we began to address the problem. To look at your grandkids and say, yeah, we knew this was likely to happen, and we didn't do anything about it because it cost too much, and to watch their world crumble, I think people are going to feel, they're going to wish that they'd done something rather than face that.
If we don't do something to curtail the amount of increase of CO2 and other greenhouse gases from 2007 forward into this century, will there be urban and rural populations right now that will become unlivable, that there will have to be movement away from vast areas that are now populated?
Absolutely. That is probably the greatest threat, is the dislocation of millions of people by changes in climate and changes in sea level. It presents a security risk, it presents an economic risk, it presents a humanitarian threat as well.
And animals and plants.
That's true too. The impacts are likely to be severe. I don't know. You can take the attitude that let the next century sort itself out. Nobody told us what the world was going to be like when we came into it. But the idea that we're making it tougher on later generations, tougher to support a world of 6, 8, 10 billion people, that bugs me. And it bugs me because we know what's coming. We know it's only going to get worse if we continue to do what we do. In the face of that information and in the face of clear evidence in the polar regions and in the tropics from storms, if we don't do anything, I think we've failed morally. What we've seen when we compare what's happened over the past 50 years with what the models show, which matched the last century fairly well until the last decade or two, and into this coming century, we're seeing in several different venues of climate analysis, in fact, we're already on a fast track for climate change. Things are proceeding more rapidly than we thought they would. The Earth may, in fact, be more sensitive to CO2 increases than we thought. And once again, yes, we're in for a certain amount of warming. There's a certain amount that we're committed to no matter what. The sooner we begin to address this, the fewer problems we'll have by the end of the next century and into the following century. We have to get this under control, or we have to admit that the world will become chaotic in another century and accept that. And I'm not willing to accept that, and I don't think anybody is. While there are many scenarios where the world may come to an end, both religious and by the hand of man, it's up to us to do the best we can while we're here and to do the best with a new perspective on what our actions mean to the future. In the past, people didn't have to think like this. The world was huge. It was bottomless as far as we could tell in terms of its resources and its ability to support us. And what we did in one generation didn't affect later generations. They had a fair shot at chopping down their own trees or building their own railroads or creating their own cities. That's not the case anymore. This world has a limited carrying capacity, and if we're not careful with it, that carrying capacity will go sharply downward. And that means millions of people will be dislocated, millions of people will die. I don't think that's something that we can conscience doing any longer. Now, do we go broke trying to fix it? I don't think we have to. I think small changes now, and particularly clever economic incentives, can get us to use the skills that we have in terms of innovation and the capitalist economy that we have to turn this around fairly fast. But what we can't tolerate is inaction. Then we're definitely committed to a much greater pain and suffering in the long run.
One action that is currently underway to help balance out the Earth's carbon dioxide release and absorption is going to put iron into the waters around the Galapagos Islands in the Pacific Ocean. The test is to see if the iron will stimulate plankton growth. Without enough iron, plankton photosynthesis is weakened. The organizer behind the iron research is the eco-restoration group called Planktos. If this test works in 2007, then iron seeding of vast ocean areas might increase plankton growth. That would help feed marine life and more plankton will also take in more carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. When the plankton die and sink to the ocean bottom, the dead plants will take CO2 with them. It's that sequestering of CO2 that Dr. Skambos was talking about. The more CO2 that can be sequestered underwater, the less will escape to the atmosphere, where a blanket of carbon dioxide keeps getting thicker and thicker around our planet.
Thanks for listening to this Earth Files podcast from the edges of science, environment, and real X-Files. Go to www.earthfiles.com to see more than 1,000 Earth Files reports with photographs, drawings, and documents. And visit Earth Files every day, every week, for new reports and new podcasts. That's www.earthfiles.com.